It's back. Yes, good. It's back. It's back. It's back. Right. Okay. So this is also related to the quite regular chronicles, and we have cases really quite recently, and historical cases of a situation where one person is the only person to survive a particular accident, catastrophe, trauma, that situation, and the emotional strain of that. I mean, you get that except in this very good Canadian film, the Super Actor. It's a film about a situation where a school bus, of a village goes over the side of a cliff or whatever, and all the children in the village are dead except for one child. And the level of some resentment towards the family that has, you know, the child was ill at then, go to school or whatever, et cetera, and the social psychology of all of that. There was a case recently, not recently, maybe 5 years ago, of a plane that went into the sea near Somalia. And there was one, I think, 11-year-old boy who survived. Everybody else on the plane was killed. I mean, it's, obviously, there are many cases where just everybody's killed. But there are also cases where just one person survived. And the psychology of whether that is, I was lucky, I was unlucky, and the trauma of that, you know, do I deserve, and do I continue to deserve the fact that I was saved when everyone else was killed, etc., is part of what we need to do. There's even an element of wisdom poetry. Do you remember wisdom poetry? Long time ago. Almost 15 months ago. Not too long to remember. Wisdom poetry, we talked about when we talked about a poem called The Wanderer, an Anglo-Saxon poem. And the idea, basically, of wisdom poetry is that you learn to be wise, you learn sabiduría through suffering. And so only those who have suffered can get really some fundamental knowledge of the world work and things. So, there's elements of that. Now, you could ask me, does that mean that fools knew the Wanderer? Almost certainly not. However, it is true that he was living for several years just before this, about 50 miles away from Exeter, where the book was, and his friend, Robert Southey, is one of the other great romantic poetry we don't study. He was actually living in Exeter, so he could easily have gone and visited his friend and found this poem in Anglo-Saxon. Probably not. It doesn't really matter. This is part of a general tradition, and there's wisdom poetry in the Bible, there's wisdom poetry in other traditions. So it can be part of that, or be a reflection of that, without necessarily knowing it. Also, the whole idea of a rudderless boat, which is by San Camino from Dumont, is a very, very frequently repeated medieval symbol. We have it in the Man of Law's Tale, El Cuento del Abogado, in the Canterbury Tales, and we have it on a number of occasions in the North. So this idea of being stuck in a boat and being taken by your destiny, all this kind of thing, has quite a long pre-modern tradition. There's also certain elements in this story that we could relate to morality plays and that sort of thing, you know, with the idea of punishment, retribution, and all of that sort of thing. Can anybody tell me the story? Mesmerized. You're assuming, you're summarizing too much. That he kills the albatross, and there is a valley to kill the albatross, and then the mist raises, and they're seeing there's a wind, and it's, oh great, you killed the albatross. And then they go into the tropical regions where the boat gets stuck, and then it was bound you killed the albatross. So, for the sailors, you have the situation where the killing of the albatross is hugely significant, but it could be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on what's happening to them. So they both interpret it as a good thing and as a bad thing. So, continue. Which conveniently they've kept for weeks and weeks. Yeah. Well, because there's no rain and there's no frost, probably. Okay, well, they come across, before the crew actually die, they come across a boat, which is very, very much geographically Caribbean. And on the boat, you have, there's two women playing dice. Yeah, and dice. One of them is death, and the other is life and death. And life and death wins the ancient man, or the young man, at this time. Young. And the rest of them die, and he continues to be alive. And so he carries on being alive, and not there yet. And he sees early on these disgusting, greasy, nasty creatures in the sea, eels and sea monsters. But after about a week, he sees them and he blesses them because they are life. At least they're alive. And so he recognizes the life that there is in death. And when that happens, it starts to rain, and the albatross pulls off his neck, etc. And he is able to go back to Scotland where he started from. What happens when he arrives in Scotland? Before that. He comes into the port, and the pilot's boat that leads you into the port, comes out, and basically his ship sinks as this pilot thing comes out, and the pilot's boy, the boy who accompanies the pilot, goes mad. But he is rescued and goes into land, and he finds a hermit. After coming on shore, he finds the hermit. So the hermit is not with the pilot. And basically, the hermit says that he has to tell his story. And so that's what he's been doing for you. By the way, you said there's this ancient man. You've got a very interesting title here. The Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. Any comments about the word rhyme? Badly written. Yes. Yes. Work relationship with the other. Rhyme is what we call hoarfrost. Hoarfrost, H-O-A-R-E, I think. Which is very, very hateful. The sort of frost that forms on windows when it's very cold. Yeah? So, that is what this word spelt like this means. It can also mean a rhyme as a luma and as an archaic spelling of that. But there is the resonance of this idea of cold frostiness. Why is that important? Where is the albatross killed? Yeah, and it's it's near to the coast of the South, quite cold, so they are travelling between glaciers and this sort of thing. We have a line of water, the ships are sailing, and ice and mist. So we have three forms of water in the same place. This is a liminal place. Yeah? It's a place which is a boundary between different worlds. And it's developed in this place where we have the killing of the albatross. Now, Ivor Coolidge is a member of Hakma or something like that, where you kill one bird and this causes the death of 100 crew members, the boy goes mad, a man has a sort of living death experience. I like birds. I don't like people killing them, but I think this is a little bit of an extreme punishment. That 200 people die with the death of this young bird. Is this crazy vegetarian thing? What possible sacred meanings could be added to it? Why might you do that? Yeah, it could be a symbol of the Holy Ghost. Why? Why can't my budgerigar, my periquito, be a symbol of the Holy Ghost? Why can't a crow be a symbol of the Holy Ghost? Why would an albatross be a symbol of the Holy Ghost? Ah, good, thank you, because of the tone. White is not the colour. White is the tone. Good. It's a white bird. Okay. So it's bigger than a dove, but it's a white bird. How's it called? With an arrow form? Bow? Crossbow. Ah, cross. Crossbow. Ballesta, crossbow, as the idea of cross. So there is the possibility that, in some sense, the albatross is a symbol of Christ, or is Christ-like. What's the other key aspect of the albatross? this album for. Help. Yeah, I mean, the Albatross was company for the crew, and the mariner does not even know why he killed it. He should have killed it out of boredom, something like that. He immediately doesn't know why he's done it. But what can we say about this Albatross specifically? Would it be the same if I went out into Lavapier Square and shot a pigeon? Could I expect 200 of my students to die and me to be condemned forever to be giving the same class about foolish? What's the difference between this albatross and a pigeon in Liverpool Square? Okay. What? Can fly. No? The albatross is the one living thing in this place. The albatross is the representation of life in a desert. So we don't normally talk about the poles or deserts, but they are deserts. They are deserts in the sense that there is a place where there's basically no other living thing. The one fundamental concept, and one of the reasons why quite a lot of the romantic poets are vegetarian, is that a romantic concept is the oneness of life. All life is sacred. All life is connected. And especially if you're in a situation where there is one living thing in a place, and you turn that place into a place with no living thing, that is potentially quite a serious thing. So, I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, we wouldn't consider it the same for somebody to maybe kill a dog, than for somebody to kill the last rhinoceros. Extinguishing a species or something like that, so even from our modern standpoint, would be something much more serious than just a big, any old bird. But it's also the situation where people kill out of passion, out of anger. People may kill out of madness. There may be a situation where they plan, and it is very much premeditated, but then we tend to take that more seriously. But killing for absolutely no reason is a more serious plan from this point of view. It's just out of boredom or something. And that if there's no intentionality, that in one sense makes it much worse. In one sense, because that makes it less terrible, but in another sense, it makes it more terrible. Is there anything else similar in the story that happens where the mariner doesn't know why? The mariner kills the albatross, but doesn't know why he's killed the albatross. Is there anything else that he does, and he doesn't know why he does it? We tell in stories, people tend to have motivations. People do things for a reason. Quite strange, this situation, where we have somebody where the central act of the whole poem is done without any motivation, without any reason. It's not a situation where he's really irritated with hearing whatever noise albatross is like. I mean, I can't. No, it's not that. He doesn't know why he does it. Just does it out of boredom, because he can. And this, if you like, is the worst sort of human attitude to nature. There may be a situation where we want to dominate it. There may be a situation where we feel it's necessary to destroy it. Obviously, the reason of the destruction of the European wolf is because we considered it dangerous. This sort of thing, the reason why there are so few bears left in Europe. Because they're presented dangerous. But just killing things because we can, but for no other reason, is a particularly human and badly human thing. But is there anything else, perhaps a contrasting thing, that the mariner does without knowing where he does it? I want an event in the story. And that's a distraction. No. I want an event. When he blesses the sea creatures, he doesn't know why he does it. It's not a case of, well, all good their life, or whatever. So we have the, and this is the beginning of his redemption process. Yeah? He's able to drink rainwater and the albatross water, because he recognizes that connection with other living things. He's broken that connection by killing the albatross, and he's recognizing it by blessing the people. You look very nice. Happy? Not very happy, okay. Again, the idea of what being hung around somebody's neck is, you know, typically you hang a crucifix around somebody's neck, so the albatross in that definitely Christian thing. One of the things that Coleridge later criticized his own poem for was having too much sort of overt Christian moral effort, like the joke, you know, he would have preferred it. And the other thing that happens when he blesses the sea creature is he's able to pray again. So that establishing the oneness of nature, that connection with the natural world, allows for a connection with the supernatural world. And as we'll see, the supernatural world is very complicated here. But the natural world responds by giving him water, by raining, and he was able to pray again and communicate with the supernatural. So, we've got as far as the rhyme. The rhyme is the poem, but also the rhyme is talking about the importance of water in a liminal state of being partly solid, partly liquid, blah, 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 related to the factor. The rhyme of the, they have nothing to say about. Ancient. What can you tell me about ancient? Okay, so we talk about ancient history. We could talk about an ancient structure. Stonehenge is an ancient structure. Do we talk about people as ancient? We can do, but it's not very, education is much more applied to things than to people, the institution, the abstraction of things. So ancient gives us this idea that this person is not entirely real and could have a symbolic quality. What about mariner? Is mariner a normal word in English? A little bit like the tempest. It's a word which people will know passively, and it makes it easy to learn French and Italian and Spanish and all these things. But they wouldn't use it naturally. Remember, if I were to say, my friend's uncle is a mariner, it would sound like I'm speaking Middle English or something. Yeah? Not a word that you would use naturally. You'd naturally say sailor. You'd naturally say the poem of the ancient sailor or the poem of the elderly sailor or something like that. So in this title is full of old-fashioned words and a lot of reverberation. Again, remember what I was saying last time, very much with the romantic as with the postmodern period, ambiguity is something to be strived for. There is no meaning to this poem. There's no answer. There are answers. There are different ways of interpreting it. There is something that we can use to make us think about all sorts of things, but it is not something where it, in the end, the answer is 24. Right? This is literature, this is not mathematics. And that is not being strived at. Now, the use of words which resonate, which give different ideas, well, the frost on the windows, ancient the structures and institutions. Where do we get this idea of this old bloke or this ancient bloke telling the story to the people who are listening? As a punishment. Yep. Nope. But lukewarm, templado. We're getting better. Have you heard of the myth or the legend of the wandering Jew? Well, there is a Central European legend about a Jewish man who laughed at the ridicule of Christ, typical of Central European anti-Semitism, who laughed at Christ on the way to Golgotha, and his punishment from God was to live eternally and to be having to tell his story generation after generation. And the last time he was supposedly spotted was in 1774 or thereabouts, so within 3 years of his lifetime. And this legend, which is medieval, somewhere in Holland, is the last time this legendary figure made his appearance. But it's part of that whole sort of Germanic, Gothic tradition of this somebody being punished for some crime. And that is where this idea comes from. What seems to be happening here is you have people who want to find causality, which we know is a human condition, the same way as abstract shapes, we will tend to see human faces, pangolia, things like that, in abstract faces, or sorry, abstract shapes, this type of thing, and we will look for causes and consequences in the story. And our stories, the stories that we tell ourselves, always have causes and consequences. Even though life doesn't. But life should happen. Yeah? But then stories should happen before. And that's the great difference. But we are so desperate to have that causality, to feel that we live in a logical, structured universe, that we spend our life telling ourselves stories in which that is the case, and expect to live in real life, even though all of the evidence is that things just happen, not because people are evil or people find things a lot better. So we have the sailors looking for a consequence, good or bad, it doesn't really matter, of the shooting of this guy, because anything has happened. That really has to happen. It's basically something like superstition in this sort of thing. And then the mariner being in a situation where he has survived, where 200 of the fellow sailors happened, and feeling guilt, which is disconnected from the crime itself. Yeah? He's not feeling guilty about killing an arbitrator. You may think, pretty stupid of him. In some ways, you might think that if you kill a wasp, yeah, you could open the window, just let the wasp go, or you could kill it with a flipper. And after killing it, you might think, I should let it go. It doesn't cause me any problem. Not with flies. Flies are horrible. I hate flies. But with something like a wasp, obviously wasps can be harmful, blah, blah, blah. But given the choice, it's obviously quicker to kill it, but it's maybe better morally not to kill it. But his feeling about guilt is to do with the 200 people who died, and that's what's driving him to do all of his days for the rest of his life, or decades, telling this story and doing nothing else. It's his feeling of guilt about the other people dying. So he's accepting the fact that they guilted him before he died, and accepting that idea of crime and retribution, even though it's not linked to the directive to the crime. And of course, there is a strong European tradition of phantasmagoria related to crime and punishment, including punishment and trial, where we look back at all of those Russian Czech people. So, there is an element of that going on. Yeah. But from the outside, yeah, we cannot see that the punishment is justified. And often people feel guilty and carry that for the cooking tree, going to the therapist, going to the psychologist, and getting rid of things. Often people feel a level of guilt which is out of all proportion to their real responsibility for things, and that's part of what happens. Now, there's a very clever game happening here, because we are told, he tells us at the end of the story, that he always knows who he has to tell the story to. It's not that lots of people are going to a wedding, ooh, this one, you, come here, I have to tell you a story. He knows who he has to tell the story to. The person is chosen by him. But he's also telling us the story. Of course, and he, the person in the story, doesn't choose us. We choose to read the poem. But by that vicarious relationship, there is the idea that we are being chosen by the poem because we need to receive this message. And what's the moral of the story? What happens to the wedding guest? The wedding guest. Does the wedding guest say, "Okay, matey, thank you for your story. I'm now going in to eat all of the nice food. There's gambas and nice things to eat, so I'm going to go there What's typical wedding food in France? What do you eat at weddings? Seafood, yeah, gambas. I, you know, at every wedding I've been to, I have been given asparagus. No, because I'm vegetarian. So it's always asparagus con mayonesa, first course, and second course, revueltos with trigueros y ajetes. I don't know why, but this is vegetarian. This is vegetarian wedding food from a Spanish perspective. I mean, obviously, it's easy to prepare quickly. I can tell you, it is paradise. It is paradise. It is paradise to be a vegetarian in Spain in 2018, 2019, compared to being a vegetarian in Spain in 1989. Being a vegetarian in Spain in the 1990s was terrible. No, they did. They hated me, and I survived. I became stronger, which is part of the message here. What happened to the wedding? He's wiser, yes. He's but wiser. He turns away from the food, sadder but wiser. Does that ring any bell? Does that sound similar to anything? Sadder but wiser? No, not related. The name of the beer, I imagine, is from a village in Germany called Budweiss, no doubt. Nothing to do with Budweiss. No. This is the same type of relationship as what is described by a man called William Blake, who talks about innocence and experience. Experience involves suffering. So experience, in innocence, in the state of innocence, yeah, you're in a much more direct relationship with God. But after experience, you can reconnect with your innocence, and you can have a greater level of revelation, a greater level of understanding from the two states. But the state of experience is a painful thing, so you are sadder but wiser from experience. So it's part of the same philosophy about these things. You're more innocent before hearing the story, but you're sadder but wiser after hearing. Right, a man called George Wally, or Daly, or Wally probably, interprets the poem as a personal allegory about Coleridge's laudanum addiction. Coleridge started taking laudanum, as I told you, for his rheumatic pains, and became addicted that way unwittingly, without intention. But he describes in his letters that laudanum, he described laudanum as free agency annihilating poison. So, un veneno que niega el libre albedrío. Free agency annihilating poison. And basically, the idea was that, you know, while in the state of being under the influence of laudanum, of course, probably like being very drunk, it might be a state of forgetfulness, of not feeling any type of pain, but he is no longer in control of himself. And from that perspective, we could understand the albatross as the wing of the benign south wind. Now, the south wind in Coleridge's philosophy, theology, world view is related to anima corpus, is related to erotic genius. So again, we're going back to the whole idea of the tiger and whether creativity and the threat of creativity. In this case, the taking of laudanum is equivalent to shooting the bringer of erotic genius, the musa, if you like, and therefore, by taking laudanum, he numbs himself to the point where he cannot write poetry. This one, no, Kublai Khan. There is, well, his probably his greatest poem is a poem that was written some years later, where he was in a hypnotic state from laudanum, and he was imagining Kublai Khan in his summer palace in China. And this is wonderful description. It's an incredible poem. And so he's in this state of dribbling and thinking about this. And he more or less wakes up and he starts writing it out, almost automatically writing it out. And then some idiot comes and knocks on the door, and he goes and answers the door, and he comes back with paper, and he can't remember any of the rest, and he stops. Because we have this incredible description, one of the best descriptions of a space, a time, a vision in the English language, and he just stops dead because suddenly this guy came from the door. Yeah. It's like, you know, the telephone ringing when you're in that moment of you're in the zone and you're writing. And that's so that there is that type of situation, and probably some of the images from this, like Frankenstein, I mean, these people are very much about connecting the two. But I don't think it's not the case of the full story coming out. There's no doubt the idea of, you know, squirmy things in the sea and this kind of things are probably bad moments with drugs, etc., etc. But not the full story in the sense of the word, probably. All of a sudden, that is not something that Kubrick's cope with. And supposedly, according to Wordsworth, it was all his idea anyway. If it was all Wordsworth's idea, it can't all be coming from a dream from Kubrick. I would say what Wordsworth says is a pinch of salt. I'm not very sure about that. But I think this is much more constructive than. Because, I mean, you can see that when you read Kublai Khan, you can see that it is just a dream vision. It's not really going anywhere. It's just fantastic. The thing is, it's a little bit like Blake, maybe on a little, well, I was going to say on a less, well, on a less personal level, it's much more influenced by the Pythagoreans and Egyptian mysticism in English. But this Coleridge also has this quite complex view of the universe and the world and how things interact. And in this poem, we have the moon representing the Virgin Mary, as well as all sorts of other things, and it's all mixing different types of religious perspective. The light of the sun is something that's described as snakes by the ancient Egyptians, I think also by the Pythagoreans. And blah, 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 blah. So it's all a bit weird. The Pythagoreans, of course, were vegetarians, but they were also, it was absolutely forbidden to eat beans. Blah, blah, blah. No, the Pythagoreans. And one of them ate beans and was murdered by the rest of the group. The Pythagoreans were a very strange group of people. Flatulentia, but I don't know if it was that formally, but it's because Pythagoras, we have the idea of Pythagoras being this great mathematician, and he was obviously a great mathematician, but it was all tied up with some really sort of weird, wildy ideas of divine order and all this type of stuff. But a lot of these things, and again, we have this idea of this clear separation. of science and superstition. It's a very, very modern thing. And the separation, even of astronomy and astrology, is relatively recent in the total sense. You have somebody like Newton, one of the fathers of modern physics, spent 10 years studying alchemy and trying to find the philosopher's stone and all that nonsense. It's not a long way distant for these people, these mixtures of them. And again, the mixture, as I said, of poetry and science. You have an interest by the poets in science, and we have scientists like Priestley who are poets. So again, the great separation between humanities and the sciences, arts and sciences, and that is part of Victorian education system. It's not part of the way people thought about this. Blah, 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 blah. Oh, yeah, yeah. 11 minutes. We're on page 9 out of 22. Good. Okay. You have all sorts of stuff there about Coleridge's Metaphysical Universe, which you can read about. Have you heard of Swedenborg? Swedenborg? I think he was, I was going to say Norwegian, it does sound like a Swedish, doesn't it? Anyway, I think he was a Norwegian theologist who was very important at this time. And he mixes that with people like Homer's Trigonistic. A lot of these, this sort of alchemy, when people study witchcraft and things like this, strange forms, that's all very much related to this guy. And it's all about the importance of fire and water and the symbolism of north and south and east and west. And you can read all about that if you read that. And you can enjoy that for yourself. Again, there is this idea of liminal spaces, people being in this moment. All sorts of literature is related to boundary blurring. I think when we were studying Volpone, and you will study Volpone in a month and a half time, you have this idea of specifically chosen the eunuch, the hermaphrodite, and the dwarf. Enano, hermaphrodita, ikastrati. All of those figures are chosen specifically because they are boundary blurring. Now, obviously, in a modern politically correct context, perceiving of such people in such ways is a negation of their individualism, etc. But from that type of point of view, from that part, a dwarf, an enano, is not a child but not an adult. A hermaphrodite is not male and not female. A castrati is not male and not female. So you have these types of figures who make society nervous because they are questioning the limits of where things change. Because constant change with thresholds, with umbrales, which are important. And of course, they're especially important for the romantics. Because the whole idea of the umbral is tied up with sublime. Sublime, the thing called the bajo del umbral. That's the idea there, and this idea of what is sublime relates to that, what goes through that perfect of limit. So these binary relationships on which we tend to simplistically understand the world lead in a very Hegelian sense to a synthesis. You have thesis, antithesis, synthesis, in Hegel. You study Hegel then? Hegel? How do you pronounce it? Hegel, as you say. Hegel. It's very much taking on those sorts of ideas. British culture is hugely influenced by German culture. In the 19th century, we have a German royal family, and we have a recognition that Britain is better, not really, probably, but in terms of philosophy, German is, especially abstract philosophy, German is written as practical philosophy, but not the not abstract philosophy like the French. There's a huge process in the First World War about all, and a little bit in the Second World War, of pretending that there's nothing German in English culture, and saying that instead of calling them Pastores Alemannes, we're going to call them Alsatians, and we're changing all the names, and the Saxe Coburgs become Windsor, and we change everything so that pretending that we're not German. But of course, especially the royal family, but an awful lot of influence is in German. And then, of course, there's a second process of that, when we can equate the Germans with the Nazis, we're not like that, blah, blah, blah. Plus, there was a huge fascist movement in Britain. We managed to defeat it, but it did exist, and it just wasn't as successful as the Nazis. But we could say that is other, that is not us, by saying that Britain was somehow not a Germanic society. But in this time, there's very, very much a recognition that England, that Britain, is a Germanic society, and there's an awful lot of connection there. And all of the Stormundstang, all of his literature of torment and tempest and Gothic, etc., has a huge amount of influence there. And of course, the great romantic painters are German. So there's these sorts of games going on, but German culture is very highly valued at this time. And of course, one of the most popular eventually people near to the throne in Britain was Prince Albert, who was directly German, etc. So we have all of that. So there's all sorts of different ways of interpreting this, and I give you lots of questions here. The royal wedding. Why is the person not going into Starbucks? Why is he going to a wedding? What do weddings represent? A beginning of, and community. So, it's the opposite of a hermit. Hermit at the end, yes. Hermit is about going into nature and through nature forming a connection with the divine, with the supernatural, by rejecting society. Weddings are a representation of the community. But they are also a threshold. They are an umbral. Your state before and after a wedding is different. So the wedding itself is a threshold. And he stops him on the threshold of the threshold. Yeah? It's the door leading into the church where the wedding is taking place. There's the threshold of a threshold. There's a double sense there. So there is this idea of community, nature, supernature, individual, as different spheres and how they relate. Is it important that the ancient mariner apparently uses hypnotism? Well, there's a special glint in his eye, and the wedding guest cannot. Not because, because the ancient mariner is so strong, that he's somehow hypnotized and mesmerized. Is that relevant? Is that important? You have to think about that. There's no answer. I don't know yet. Is it important that he was one of the three? One of three. Three guys going into a wedding. You. You two go. You. He's one of three. Yeah? He could be in a group of, it could be a whole rugby team. He could be in a group of 15. Or he could be in a group of five. But he's one of three. Is whatever, who knows? Possibly, yes. I'm asking, I'm not kidding, there's no answer. You just have to think. Yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah. The idea of the Trinity is the albatross Christ, or is the albatross simply Christ-like? Again, with the whole idea of crucifixion crossroads and all that. Is it important that the mariner's crime is not a crime under human law? And it may be possible that nowadays you might get fined for killing an albatross, but certainly at that time, it's not a crime in human terms. It might be a crime in cosmic terms and divine terms. But is that important? Why do romantics get so excited about hermits? Yeah? Hermits are always important. Where have we seen hermits? Well, I'm talking about romantics. So far, in theory, you have seen 5 romantic poems. Are there any hermits in the taiga? Not. Are there any poets in infant joy? Not. Infant sorrow? Not. Are there any poets in daffodil? Did you read your Wordsworth? You have to read your Wordsworth tutorial, people. There are hermits in Tintin Abbey. Yeah? But you haven't prepared your Wordsworth. Prepare your Wordsworth. We're not going to study Wordsworth because I don't like Wordsworth. And we haven't got time to do all the tutorials. But it could easily come up. Yeah? Don't just ignore him. And do not complain to me, because I have this recorded. Do not complain to me if Wordsworth comes up in the exam and you say, you didn't study him in class. I don't know what's going to come up in the exam. It's part of the course. You have a recording of an hour and a half tutorial of it on the internet, and you have the tutorial notes. It is your responsibility. I'm happy to answer questions any time about Wordsworth. His poetry is all me. It's Keats, who is God. Keats is wonderful. Keats described Wordsworth's poetry as the egotistical sublime. But it's all about how incredible I am, in one sense or another. And he's a clever poet, he's a good poet, but I just find it eventually irritating that everything is about him. He's actually probably a much better person, a much nicer person than most of these other people. Most poets are horrible people. But I just don't think he likes you are free to, you can like it if you like. There's, for example, Daffodil is, I don't know if in Spain there is anything really, a really cliched poem. It's a sort of typical poem that everybody knows that is just a bit sort of, just too worn out, you've heard it too often. And, daffodils is used by the Cumbrian tourist agency. They've even actually made a rap version of daffodils with a singing score. It's just a popular thing by overuse. But, there's some interesting stuff there. But if you compare him to Keats, it's just game over. Keats is just so much better. Or I can connect so much more easily with Keats, whatever. But even Shelley, but Keats is much better. Anyway, next week, we will look at Percy Bysshe Shelley. So, you only have to read 2 poems. I will post on the internet footnoted versions of those 2 poems. So please, they're not sonnets, but they're not particularly long. They're not long like this. You please come to class with them read and with the footnotes read so that you have some sort of idea of what you're talking about. Because it means that there's much more possibility for us to interact. Bye-bye!